Anthony myself, Anatoly Kovalev, judge of the Supreme Court of Human Rights, elect on behalf of the Russian Federation, is my official title. Not a Russian judge, not a Russian representative in the European Court, but just judge elected on behalf of the Russian Federation. Because each judge elected on behalf of each country is a judge of the court. And certainly he's a national judge. That's what it's a very important thing to underline. Well, and my task today is perhaps to let you know about systemic problems, you know, of our legal system, as a Russian legal system, view from Strasbourg, because I know there are other views, and we shall listen to my esteemed colleague Volkov and others, and I would like, nevertheless, give some preliminary remarks. During the years of the so-called Brezhnev Zastoy stagnation era, Soviet scholars and lawyers, especially in the institute where I work, Institute of State and Law of Russian Academy of Sciences, began to elaborate new approaches other than the existing class approach. And we constituted a team led by Professor Tumanov, the former president of the Constitutional Court, the future at this time. Yes, and other colleagues as an Armenian Nersesyans, a Georgian Chikvadze, an Estonian Ray Müllerson, an Azerbaijani Guliev, and the Russian Anatoly Kovalev, who was at this time the head of the Center of Comparative Law, we started to elaborate new approaches of the human rights issues concerning the Soviet Union. And the first step was to move the subject from the relationship state and individual. As was the title of the section of the Brezhnev Constitution, to the domain of rights and freedoms of individual and citizen as a value in itself. It was the main issue of our efforts and remarkable fact. The last act of the disintegrating Soviet Union, Soviet Empire, was the adoption of the 5th September 1991 of the Declaration of Human Rights and Freedoms, which we elaborated 3 years ago and put on the table of Gorbachev, and only when he wanted to finish honorably his task, he remained at the Institute of State and Law, proposed this declaration, and this became the last act of the Soviet Union, a last pardon to its citizens of the centuries, perhaps those of years of suffering. And it was adopted, this declaration, which proclaimed liberty of a human being, his honor and dignity, is a supreme value of our society. And it was a kind of message sent to the future generations, and a kind of message also for the legislatures. And we drafted the Constitution of 1993, keeping in mind this declaration and this code put on the declaration. Yes. And very often, this process of maturing on a new value system is very often underestimated by the Occidental scholars and public opinion, because for them it's widely accepted that only after admission of the Russian Federation to this democratic club of European societies as the Council of Europe, Russia joined European values of human rights. This book began much before. It began with Marx, if you want it. It's not also an accident of the story when Pustagar began to write his book under the Soviet time. He was my head, because he was the vice director of the institute. I was at this time a director of the Department of Legal Information, and we gathered all the information concerning Martin's. We worked also for this book. This book began just before the entrance of Russia to the European Court. It was prepared intellectually and politically and juridically, and of course, this legal foundation for acceptance of the Universal Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms by Russia were held down in the new constitution of the post-Soviet Russia. Professor Marichkin cited these articles of the Constitution of the Russian Federation concerning universally recognized principles and norms of international law. But moreover, the practical issue of the protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms from the point of view of domestic application of the provision of international law is secured by Article 46, paragraph 3 of the Constitution of the Russian Federation, which stipulates, I can quote, "Everyone shall have the right, in accordance with international treaties of the Russian Federation, to appeal to international institutions for the protection of human rights and freedoms if all available domestic remedies have been exhausted." It's a clear cut from the Article 35 of the European Convention of Human Rights. I participated in the drafting of this article. I can confess to you that we wrote this article keeping in mind our future participation in the European Convention of Human Rights. And on the 7th of May 1992, the Russian Federation officially asked the admission to the Council of Europe. The convention was ratified by the federal law of 30 March 1998 and entered into force on the 6th of May 1998, the historical date, because from this date the citizens of Russian Federation can complain on the violation who had took place after this date to the European Court of Human Rights. And the federal law stipulated, I can quote, "The Russian Federation, as a part of the Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms, accepts the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights as binding on matters of the interpretation and application of Convention and its protocols in the case of a presumed infringement by the Russian Federation of the provisions of these treaty documents when the presumed infringement occurred after its entry into force in relation to the Russian Federation." Section 1 of this law. And the decision of the plenary session of the Supreme Court of Russian Federation, I don't want to eat the bread of Mr. Burkov, of 5th October 2003 on the implementation of international laws by Russian courts underlined this fact that Russia is bounded by these provisions and this ratification. 12 years of the implementation of Russian by Russia of the convention has a good result. Over 1,400 judgments were delivered by the European Court versus Russian Federation. No better the result, yes. And of course, this impressive number of judgments allow to bring to light some tendencies. Now, we can speak now about some tendencies. And these tendencies are called in our law, structure of law, as systemic problems or structural problems. What is this structural problems and what is the meaning of this notion? I'm obliged to come back to the story because the 12th of May, the Committee of Ministers of Council of Europe, which by virtue of Article 46 of the European Convention supervises the execution of the European Court's judgments, adopted this famous resolution of 12th May. It invited the European Court to identify in its judgments, as far as it's possible, wherever the Court deals with so-called repetitive violations, the existence of an underlying systemic problem and the source of this problem. And this step by the Committee of Ministers was caused by several reasons. Which are these reasons? First of all, a duty to take individual and general measures imposed on the respondent states with a view to remove the effects of violations established by the European Court. Also, taking in mind a disastrous increase of the number of applications coming from each countries of the Convention, which have not been examined by the European Court. More than a half of applications coming to Strasbourg are coming from five countries, champions. They are the champions. Russia, Turkey, Romania, Poland, Ukraine. These five countries give more than 60% of applications, because of course there is countries, great countries with millions of inhabitants, and little bigger than Andorra and Monaco. Yes, but the fact is rather relevant. And the Committee of Ministers de facto returned to the European Court a part of the powers acquired by the former, by which on which it could require violating states to take general measures. In any sense, the bureaucrats of Council of Europe reimbursed on the European Court the task to supervise the execution of the European Court of Human Rights and to find systemic violations. Now it was a task, bloody task if you want, of the European Court to deal with this issue. And the first judgment delivered by the court in this issue was the famous Briovsky versus Poland judgment on 22 June 2004, and Sage versus Italy, the judgment on the 1st March 2006, as well as a number of other judgments rendered by the Grand Chamber and the small chambers of the court. There was also the case of Kapetsky versus Slovakia and others, Kutnyshapska versus Poland, Lukanda versus Slovenia, Ildiz versus Turkey, etc., etc. And what is the motivation in the operative part of the judgment? How the European Court defines this systemic problem? For example, in the Briovsky case, the problem was the mechanism of reimburse the citizens of the Bug River who were displaced after the Second World War, and the state promised to more than 1 million of his citizens to compensate this remove from the Bug River border to the rest of the country. And the European Court held in this Briovsky case, I can quote, it's point three of the operative part of the judgment on Briovsky. The court held that the above violation was originated in a systemic problem connected with the malfunctioning of domestic legislation and practice caused by the failure to set up an effective mechanism to implement the right to credit of Bug River claimants. Four, hold that the respondent state must, through appropriate legal measures and administrative practices, secure the implementation of the property rights in question in respect of the remaining Bug River claimants, or provide them with equivalent redress in lieu, in accordance with the principles of protection of property rights under Article 1 of the Protocol 1 of the Convention. And Poland was obliged to adopt respective measures, legislative and practical measures, to satisfy the claimants. Their number was more than potentially 80,000 of potential claimants before the court. And they saved the court from the claims. And of course, Russia, as a great client of the European Court, also knew and knows its own systemic problems. As Tolstoy said in the beginning of Anna Karenina, each happy family is happy in the same manner. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its proper manner. And each country has his unhappy problems before the European Court. For example, the Italy, the length of procedure, Poland and Romania, non-execution of domestic judgments, etc., etc. Turkey conditions of in detention on remand, etc. And Russia also, with the impressive number of applications, can be qualified as a country who has some systemic problems. But first of all, a little bit of statistics. The highest number of applications that we received was per year was this number of applications in 2010. In 2011, a little bit less, and because of the Board of Judgment number 2, I'll speak about it tomorrow, but the record year was 2010, more than 14,000 thousands of applications.
I have one technical question, so I'm going to interrupt. When the case is against certain state is decided, I mean not the admissibility decision, but the, in substance, the panel who decides it, does the charge from this concrete country belongs usually to the panel?
Yes.
So it means that if there is a 1,400 cases against Russia,
yes,
then all the time the Russian charge has to be in.
Yes, in theory, yes, but
okay.
I am not so unhappy because more than 92% of applications coming to Strasbourg from all the countries of Europe are recognized as inadmissible for formal reasons. And now we have more than 5,000 Russian pending serious cases. Of course, the participation of national judges is obligatory. You vote, and very often there is a kind of code of honor. The national judge is more severe with its own country than the rest of the chamber. And what are the major structural problems concerning Russia? For a long time, the biggest and the most important problem was the state's failure to comply with domestic court decisions. And more than 40% of applications concern this problem. Why? Because the national courts delivered good judgments, but they were not enforced, especially judgment concerning payment of salaries, social benefits, etc., etc. They were not executed. In some regions, only 10% of judgments were executed. Lack of money, lack of possibilities, etc. And for a long time, it was the largest recurrent problem, more than 40%, as I told, of our judgments. In January 2009, the court delivered its first pilot judgment against Russia. Pilot judgment means the judgment concerning structural problems. Case Burdov number 2, my personal choice, because the first judgment delivered against Russia was on the 7th of May 2009. And 7 years after, we delivered judgment Burdov number 2, when we stipulated that for the first time the European Court's judgment were enforced, but then Burdov was obliged again to be a claimant before the European Court because of the non-enforcement of other judgments concerning his Chernobyl pension. And it was symbolically because the first case, Burdov number 1 of 2002, was the very first judgment finding the same violation in respect of the same epithet. right to accord and right to profit. The Pilot Judgment ordered Russia to set up an effective domestic remedy against such violations and to settle all similar cases pending before the court. In response, Russia adopted a legal reform of May 2010, introducing a domestic compensation mechanism, the so-called Compensation Act, I'll speak about it tomorrow, and ordered redress to almost 1,000 applications whose cases were adjourned by the court. And the court found that the new domestic remedy must be used by the applicants before bringing their complaints to Strasbourg, and dismissed several hundreds of new cases for failure to do so. For example, the famous Nagaritsyn and Nalgiev cases. As a result, the number of such cases before the court had radically decreased in 2011. And if before we had 40% of this category of applications, now we have only 7-8% of these applications concerning Russia. The decrease is rather evident. The second problem is the breach of the legal certainty requirements in civil proceedings before courts of general jurisdiction, a famous Russian nadzor. We use this term without translation in our judgment. All the judges of the European Court understand what does mean nadzor, supervisory review, nadzor in Russia. This breach of legal certainty before courts of general jurisdiction is the second major issue in terms of applications lodged by the violations found. And they result from the caution of final domestic judgment in the applicant's favor through supervisory review of other similar proceedings. For example, the domestic court in Tumen orders to pay the applicant benefits concerning his social rights. It's not executed during 2-3 years, and that then is quashed by supervisory review under the complaint put by the prosecutor or second instance jurisdiction, and the application, the judgment who entered into force is quashed, is not more applicable. It's also a violation of the principle that we know from the theory of law and was known by the Romans, res judicata, res judicata. A right obtained by the court decision, res judicata. And in 2003, the court found its first violation of the convention on that account in the case of Ryabykh versus Russia. I'm obliged to write once again. Because in Ryabykh case, very interesting case, I remember that the persistence of the judge of the first jurisdiction who decided in favor of Mrs. Ryabykh was quashed five times. The supervisory review instance sent back the case, and once again the same judge decided in favor of the Ryabykh. She merits a monument in her small town in Belgorod region. And the court repeated such findings in hundreds of similar cases. Since then, also there were some exceptions where the quashing of final judgments was justified due to the exceptional circumstances. It was also the famous case of Suchernik versus Russia, represented by Winston Bordeaux. Yes, and I was dissenting in this case. And in April 2011, the court addressed the remaining structural problems and the prospects of the pathogenic procedure in the case of Ryabkin versus Russia still pending. We communicated this case and we sent a message to the Russian authorities. If you don't remedy this problem, we shall adopt a pilot judgment obliging you to adopt serious legislative measures. Third problem is an excessive length of detention pending trial. In some cases, this length of detention pending trial can go up to 3-4 years. You can imagine, you are in jail before your trial for 2-3 years. Yes. And lack of reasons for continued detention on remand, several judgments found that there were no sufficient guarantees against arbitrariness and no judicial review during detention pending extradition. It's also a new problem for Russian system, cases concerning pending extradition. Yes, and in most cases, the court also found that the applicants who claimed that there existed a well-founded risk of torture in the country requiring their extradition had not received adequate review of these claims. Lenin versus Russia, Garabayev, Mr. Loyev, Muminov versus Russia, and other cases. And from this case, we can go from this problem directly to the problem of poor conditions of the pretrial detention. Because if the pretrial detention is too long, of course, the number of detainees are accumulating, and all the prisons in group are everywhere overcrowded. In Russia, in Italy, in France, in Ukraine, and of course Russia is perhaps the most serious example of this problem. And the problem of poor conditions of pretrial detention was frequently found to violate Article 3 of the Convention, inhuman degrading treatment, and even sometimes torture. And starting with the case Kalashnikov, 2002 Kalashnikov case. Nothing with this Kalashnikov. Yes, but the title of the Izvestia newspaper was Russia enters to Europe with Kalashnikov. What imagination of journalists. And in this case, there's a case concerning the detention of remand number one in Magadan, in Kamchatka. You know, Kamchatka is near Alaska, in the extreme north of Russia. The court found the conditions of pretrial detention inhuman due to the overcrowding and poor hygienic and medical facilities. And it had made similar findings in some 90 cases since 2002. In January 2 of this year, and 10th of January 2012, the court delivered a final judgment addressing in great detail the underlying structural problems and indicating various ways to resolve them. We shall speak about this case, Ananya versus Russia, tomorrow in details. And the court noted the help that the authorities must submit to the Committee of Ministers within 6 months in binding time frame for introduction of both preventive and compensatory remedies to ensure adequate domestic redress for such violations. The court also ordered to grant such redress within a year to all the applicants who have complained of poor conditions of their pretrial detention before the court, on the same line as what the execution of Bordov number 2 judgment concerning the other issue. Other violations of Article 3 were found by the court due to the conditions of transportation of the accused and from the trial and to their detention. But more important is the final violation of torture and ill-treatment in police custody was also find in several cases, Mikheyev, Menishova, Maslova, and Nalbandyan, and etc. A separate serious problem often arises in respect of the medical treatment of the applicants quite detention. And the court often concludes that the medical assistance was insufficient to the extent that it disclosed a breach of Article 3 in many cases. But the most known is Alexanyan versus Russia in December 2009. And of course, last but not least, the court received about 600 individual complaints from Chechnya, most of them filed under Article 2 and 3 of the Convention, and about 250 judgments delivered on this net issue. First of all, use of lethal force, extrajudicial executions, unlawful detentions, torture and ill treatment, and especially disappearances, as in Bazorkina case, destruction of property, restriction of freedom on movement. But the court also found that effective domestic remedies were not available, and in 2010 indicated the need for an investigation under Article 46 in one such case, Abuja versus Russia. This it also looks as a systemic problem, and the court is prepared also a pilot procedure concerning this issue, and it will be also a topic of our conference in future days. Of course, there are other issues who are common for many countries before the European Court, but I must say that the length of judicial proceedings is not the Russian problem. It's moreover the problem of Italy or Greece, even in France. I'm often judge rapporteur in Italian cases because of my knowledge of Italian system, and I had cases where the civil procedure duration was 33 years in Italy. Of course, we don't have this such a recourse in Russia, but nevertheless, it's also a kind of problem, but especially the problem concerning the guarantee in the proceedings. Because in many cases, the parties are not informed about the date of the cassation procedure, or informed later than the procedure took place. In some cases, as Kivirikov versus Russia, the judgment delivered by the tribunals were not motivated, because Russian legislation permit to give information 5 days after the pronouncement of the judgment, and these limits are not respected in many cases. And there are other issues arising under various articles of the Convention, special Article 8 concerning severe environmental pollution and the right to be relocated from the area upon a court order, as in Fadeva case, or limitation of the prisoner's correspondence, also Article 8 issue. Many cases concerning many other countries, disputes concerning the children in the separated families, etc. And of course, some issues concerning Articles 9, liberty of consciousness, Article 10, liberty of freedom, and Article 11, liberty of association. We had some interesting cases concerning Scientology, church, or Jehovah's Witnesses, some cases concerning the right to participate in elections, the case Republican Party versus the Russian Federation, and also cases concerning the dismissal of judges, which has been the case for the critics, public critics, and some cases concerning limits of freedom of expression. In some cases, we found violation, as in Greenberg and other cases concerning Russia, but in some cases, for example, Paskov versus Russia, we didn't find any violation because the case deals with the limits of freedom of expression on the military journalists. You see, we have a variety of cases concerning also right of property and also freedom of movement, And also some cases concerning so-called extraterritorial jurisdiction of respondent states in the heat of the season of the European Court. Last 10 years, we are very passionate by all these cases, Cyprus versus Turkey, Latvia versus Russia, Aladzene versus United Kingdom, when the court established an extraterritorial responsibility of states concerning the acts of its agents outside the territory of the respondent states. But you see, the main problem is how to remedy this systemic problem, of course. And tomorrow we shall speak about these problems. As an example, I'll present you two cases, Burdov 2 and Anani. I hope you can find it in your book, in your electronic systems. If not, I'll bring the paper version and to show what was the paper version. Well, now we have some minutes to questions and replies, if you have something to
some questions about this supervising authority. How many years after the judgment, the final judgment, can this supervising authority quash the judgment?
No, let's distinguish two things on the national level. Yes?
Yes, on the national level.
Yes. There are some provisions, and I don't also, I'm obliged to eat the bread of my colleagues. There are some norms in the Russian procedure legislation. The first was Article 213 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. Then Article 311 of the Code of Arbitration Procedure, and now Article 392 of the Code of Civil Procedure. All these articles stipulate that if the Constitutional Court of the Russian Federation or the European Court of Human Rights establishes a violation of the rights of the claimants in the concrete cases, the national tribunals can quash all the judgments and to retrial the case. As a new circumstance, because the decision of the Constitutional Court and of the European Court of Human Rights are considered as a new circumstances, who give right to reconsider the case. This is, I don't know about the criminal and about the civil cases, but last year only the Supreme Court of the Russian Federation quashed more than 90 judgments concerning the applicants of the European Court in criminal procedure. Yes. It sent back these cases to the first jurisdiction level. Yes, it's mechanism is working well, and it's provided by now by this provisions of the domestic procedural law. Of course, it was a struggle, a very especially on this issue of the Code of Civil Procedure. But at least we overcome, and now this norm is in force from the 1st of January 2010, I wonder. But another mechanism is the supervisory of the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe. Each Wednesday, all the 47 ambassadors of the countries represented in Strasbourg are convoked by the Committee of Ministers, and they must reply how do they respect the judgments of the European Court. It's a black date for the ambassadors, yes, this day, and now, under the supervisory of the Committee of Ministers, there are more than 3,000 non-enforcement judgments of 36 countries. Bad pupils and bad participants. participants of the camp, because there is a necessity not to adopt individual measures to pay the award decided by the European Court, but also to adopt so-called general measures, preventing the same violations in the future. It's the most difficult task. Russia pay, the best player in the Council of Europe is Russia. Russia pays all the awards, even astronomical awards in Chechen cases, in Alaska case, etc. But concerning general measures, it's more difficult task for each country. For example, we had the case L versus Lithuania, in which the court ordered to Lithuania to adopt in 3 months a new legislation concerning the right of transsexuals. Is it possible, realistically speaking, to reinforce the legislation concerning this issue? It's not possible. Of course, if you decide in a small country, you can do everything, but nevertheless, and that's because we underline the importance of this principle of subsidiarity. The main human rights protection task must be executed on the national levels, and the court is the final instance when all the national remedies are exhausted. That's because Russia, unlike other countries, adopted this measure in its procedural law to execute the judgments of the European Court.
You cited the federal law when the convention was ratified, and there was something like this, that Russia is bound with a case law which is decided against Russia.
Yeah, but
what concerns the other cases, for example, I don't know,
The authorities of each respondent state must take in account the legal positions of the European Court. That's because when we adopt judgments against Russia, we cite the similar judgments against other countries, and vice versa. Russia enriched now the case law of the European Court by many cases. And that's because we are speaking very often about this erga omnes principle. Erga omnes principle means that the legal positions of the European Court must be took into consideration by other countries, even they are not respondent states. Erga omnes. For others, it's a pedagogical reason. And very often, when we adopt our judgment concerning Russia, we have in our section an Estonian judge, a Norwegian judge, Danish judge, a Greek judge, and we try to be more pedagogic as possible, because to send the message to other countries that it also can be their problems. That because when you read the judgments concerning the decision of the Constitutional Court of Russian Federation or Supreme Court, and now also of the first and second instance courts in Russia, you can find often the quotations, not only the judgments concerning Russia, but other countries. It's a good example. And the best and the most brilliant example is the Constitutional Court of the Russian Federation, because they take into account not only the facts of the judgment, but they explain the legal positions of the court concerning different issues. And we will say, you can find very often in the judgments of the European Court when we cite the positions of the Supreme Court of Estonia, of Russia, of Greece, and we try to establish a dialogue between jurisdictions. And that's because one of the main most favorite topics of our seminars is a dialogue of judgments, of judges, because national judge and European judge. And this is a kind of dialogue, because we dialogue through exchange of the texts and the quotation of each other. And because this principle ergo omnes helps to send a message that even the judgment is concerned not the Russia, but you must keep in mind.
But I mean, just in principle, in practice, does it is it accepted in Russia?
It depends. It depends. It depends on generations. It depends on generation. Young generation accepts. Old generation, as the mind, is not very enthusiastic. It is not only the Russian phenomenon. Nevertheless, now, because there are not more a hunger of information, we publish two specialized reviews in Russia, Human Rights, the Practice of European Court, and the third one, the Bulletin of the European Court of Human Rights. Russia is the only country of Europe who translates into national language the official Bulletin of the European Court of Human Rights, is published in English and in French. And all the tribunals are obliged to subscribe to at least one copy of this bulletin. Yes. And they read, when they come to Strasbourg, they know not only judgments of concerning Russia, but also judgments concerning other countries. Yes. Perhaps everybody was passionate by this Lautz case, the famous Lautz case against Italy. Yes, crucified in public schools. Now we should have a case versus Britain, the prohibition to teachers to put crucifixes on their body and to influence. And many countries want to enter as a third intervener in this case. That proves that it is consistent with the common interest. Because, for example, in Lautz case, we had 20 countries who intervened. Russia complied. 20 countries, from Monaco to Russia. Yes. They intervened to this case to support the positions of the Italian government. Yes.
Anatoly, I have also one question, if it's all right. And actually, this also relates to what, Sergei, you were teaching. So let's look at this recent Markin case, which also demonstrated a certain tension between the Strasbourg court and the Russian constitutional court. So the chairman of Russia's constitutional court, Valery Zorkin, wrote quite an emotional article in Российская газета, «Предел устойчивости», or marginal giving in, where one of the main arguments is that, interestingly, he's relying on a precedent of the German constitutional court, a case called Görgülü.
Yes.
And indeed, in this case, the German Constitutional Court said that while our constitutional system is very international law friendly, nothing bad happens if sometimes when our constitutional identity is violated, if we would not, honor a particular international legal obligation, that wouldn't change the fact that altogether we would be international law friendly. And it is interesting that Judge Sorkin picked this precedent up and referred to. And basically, he made the argument that Russia might have some sort of red line of constitutional identity or sovereignty or whatever you call it.
No, you know, the case is much rather specific case, because after some years of honeymoon between the Strasbourg and the Constitutional Court, the first, after 200 cases, when we cited abundantly the Constitutional Court in a positive way, for the first time we did it in a negative way. And it was a crisis of jealousy and bad humor, etc., etc. But we had the same problems, not only with Russia. You know, this war between, between the Strasbourg Court and the United Kingdom, the Hearst versus United Kingdom, the prohibition to prisoners to vote, yes. And the British Parliament refused to amend the legislation. Only 20 votes were for the amendment and 240 against. It was a very, very strong crisis between Strasbourg and Great Britain.
But
in each country, periodically, we have these problems. Yes, we have these problems. Sorry?
In this case, they decided that they did pray for them and to change the legislation.
It was not decided yet. It was not decided yet because last year the court adopted two similar judgments concerning the United Kingdom, in which he underlined that we didn't yet enforce the first legislation. That is the first judgment. Yes. It was not by the British legislation. And I can give you many other examples concerning Austria, etc. But the problem is, of course, the problem is perhaps, if you want to let me be short, it's a conflict of interpretation. Conflict of interpretation. But there are also conflicts of interpretation between the different courts of the same country. The same country. You have the same conflict between the Cassation Court of France and Conseil d'Etat. You have the same tensions between the Supreme Court of Russia and Constitutional Court of Russia, etc. But the problem is that there is a kind of jealousy concerning the prerogatives of high institutions. Yes. And each high court of each country, small or big country, it seems to them that they are the highest court, they are best placed, and it's true, to resolve national problems, but Strasbourg must only give some indication. That's because when the Council of Ministers of Europe adopted the resolution 204, me and the Polish judge Lech Garlicki, we published two articles condemning this public judgment procedure, because the public judgment procedure is the executive body of Council refers to the court the dirty task to indicate general measures. Because in the heart of the European system is the individual petition, Article 34 of the Convention. And it's a source of conflicts, future conflicts, of course. But we shall speak about it perhaps on another issue. Thank you for your attention, because you have a right to human and not degraded treatment.